Evening, everybody. So let's cultivate our motivation. And especially this week when there is so much turmoil in Egypt and so much danger to people's lives, let's appreciate that we live in a place where we have freedom and in a place where it's comparatively peaceful, and appreciate how those circumstances give us the opportunity to practice the Dharma. So it's hard to practice when you fear for your life, when there's chaos and social upheaval all around. So while we have this opportunity and these conditions, let's really make use of them and apply ourselves to the Dharma practice for the benefit of all sentient beings. This week, especially all the people in Egypt, whether we agree with their policies or not, all of them are suffering. And so let's work on the path to attain full Buddhahood for the benefit of all these beings. Okay, so we'll start. So there was a question from last week asking, how would you address the view that the mind is simply a byproduct or side effect of or a hallucination resulting from the chemical and neurological processes of the body and the brain? Okay. Well, I would first ask that person to tell me, to prove their argument that the mind is a byproduct of the chemical and electrical processes in the brain. Okay? Because I can't explain why that's not so until I hear their reasons why it is so. Okay? So you ask the question, what are the reasons?
I don't think that.
You don't think that? Okay.
I was talking with someone who said something like that.
Yeah. Before. Yeah, well, you know, if you're talking with somebody who says that, then I would say, please explain to me the reasons that would prove that that is the case. Yeah. Because somebody says, prove to me why it's not like this. I mean, why should you have to prove why it's not like that if they haven't been able to explain why it is like that?
So what if, like, the reasoning might be that because when the brain information or activity is seen through the scientific data, it's correlating with the different mental states, and that we can correlate different hormones and different chemicals in our bodies to different mental emotional states.
Okay, so let's say somebody says, because you can correlate, let's say if you do
EEG. Probably not correlate.
Huh?
They would probably say it's causing it, not just correlating it.
Okay, that, well, then you would have to say, if somebody says because those chemical and biological processes cause the mental feelings and emotions, then I would say, why? Prove that they cause. Because all science can do is say that there's a correlation. They can't, you know, there's no proof that one causes the other yet. Yeah. So just because there's a correlation doesn't mean that there's a causal thing going on. Okay? I talked to a professor at Harvard once, and he had that view, and I asked him why, and he said, well, if you think that at one time there were just inanimate things, and then there became plants, which had the ability to reproduce themselves, then the next step there is to have consciousness. You know, so he just saw it as an evolutionary process from inanimate to biologically alive to having consciousness. Okay? But again, you can't prove that the brain and the body cause those states or are the byproduct. You can't prove that the consciousness is a byproduct of the brain and the body. Yeah. You can't prove it. And you know, our instinctual sense, you know, like when we're unhappy, I asked one of the scientists this one time, I said, when you're unhappy, do you say, oh, it's just the dopamine or serotonin or whatever it is in my brain that isn't sufficient?
What's my life?
Yeah. So, I mean, is that what you think? If you're happy, do you say, oh, do you think, oh, my chemical electrical processes are working well? No, you say I'm happy, don't you? You don't say my brain chemistry is doing this and that. Yeah. Because just in our own experience, we differentiate the experience of a living being versus the activities of chemicals. And, you know, when you... It reminds me of that other scientist, you know? I mean, when you're with somebody you love, do you say, you know, instead of saying, I love you, do you say, you know, this synapse is connecting, you know, and is working really well now. That's real romantic, isn't it? Yeah? So, no, we don't say that, do we? We don't even think it.
What did they say?
I don't know. Yeah. So, you know, I would like to hear some really solid arguments that could prove that things that lack consciousness are the cause of consciousness. Yeah? If somebody can give some solid arguments for that, then we can have some discussion. But if you just say that, you know, that you push certain areas of the brain and people feel certain things, you know, that doesn't mean that the consciousness is a byproduct of the brain. Yeah?
Do you think that it's fundamentally impossible to prove that because consciousness is not material? You can't.
Yeah, from a Buddhist viewpoint, consciousness is not material. Yeah. So, you know, if I think that's one of the basic premises that people have to accept. If you accept that the brain is material and the consciousness is not material, then you have to ask yourself, what is the substantial cause of material things and what is the substantial cause of immaterial things like consciousness?
And how would you go about trying to lead someone through a reasoning or just through reasoning to get them, if they're really stuck in this view, to get them to that point that consciousness does not matter?
Well, so if somebody's really stuck in the view thinking consciousness is matter, then, you know, then, I mean, when you put a brain on the table, do you say there's a person there? Yeah? If science could make it, even so that the brain the synapses were doing things, and you put a brain on the table and you prodded it with some electric thing so the synapses would start to fire. Would you say there's a person there? But I think, first, those people have to come up with some good reasons to prove their argument. Okay, so we finished the... we've been talking about the specific ways to meditate on the four objects. Okay, so we've completed the body, feelings, mind, and now we're going to start phenomena. And so in the root text, the line that we're going to explain, it says phenomena, that is the mental factors and so forth, have their own individual natures. Okay? So what this means is that the phenomena, okay, especially the mental factors, we can see them as, what to adopt and what to discard. Yeah, we hear this phraseology a lot on the path, what to abandon and what to practice, So this two things. And, so often even when I lead motivations at the beginning of talks, I say, so that we can understand and relinquish our bad qualities, and so that we can actualize our good qualities. So this is the whole thing, that there's things to adopt and things to abandon, things to practice, things to relinquish. Okay? And so these things can be divided into those two classes. Sometimes they're called the pure class and the impure class. And so knowing that leads us to understand the fourth noble truth, the true path, because in the true path, what you're doing is cultivating all the things to adopt, and in that way, relinquishing all the things to give up. Okay? So when we understand that the mind is not the self after doing the establishment of mindfulness on the mind, then it's much easier to understand that there's no inherently existent mental factors, wholesome mental factors, unwholesome mental factors, to be accepted or rejected by an independent self. Okay? Because if we see through the mindfulness of the mind that there's no independent self, then of course there's nothing to adopt and discard by that independent self. Okay? Nevertheless, on the conventional level, there are things to adopt and things to discard. And being mindful and aware of these leads us so that we will understand the true paths, and start cultivating those things that need to be cultivated. Okay, so I thought what I would go through is there's lists, of course, Buddhism always has lists, of, we talk about 53 phenomena of the afflicted class, and I believe it's 55 phenomena of the pure class, so 108 phenomena altogether, okay? And so here you can, if we see them, we can see, the things that we want to give up or that we will give up in order to attain liberation and the things that we will cultivate in order to attain liberation. Okay? So we start out with the 53 phenomena of the afflicted class, okay? Or what this one would call impure phenomena. Okay? So the way the numbering goes doesn't always make sense. Sometimes, like you'll have a group, like we start out with the five aggregates, and their numbers 1 through 5. But other times we'll have a group of five things and they will just be one number. Okay, so I'll tell you when that happens. Okay, so in terms of the impure phenomena that we will be relinquishing, okay, are the five aggregates, which are under the influence of karma and afflictions. Okay? So, you know, of course, the Buddha has five aggregates too, but those are purified aggregates. So here we're talking about the ones under the influence of karma and afflictions. So those are the first five. Then the next six are the six sense powers. Okay? So again, these six sense powers under the control of afflictions and karma. So, you know, the visual sense power, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and mental sense power. Okay, so there, those are 6 through 11. Then 12 to 17 are the consciousnesses that depend on those six powers. Okay, so visual consciousness, etc., up through mental consciousness. And then 18 to 23 are the objects of those consciousnesses. So visible form, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations, and mental phenomena. Okay, so that brings us to 23. Then the next six, and those are all, you know, under the influence of afflictions and karma, then the next six are the six kinds of contact that arise from, you know, a sense power and a object and a consciousness coming together. Okay? So you have the, you know, the contact upon the coming together of the visual form, the eye sense power, and the, you know, and the visual consciousness. Okay? Again, up through mental consciousness. Then, so that's 24 to 29. Then 30 to 35 are the six feelings that arise from these six contacts. Okay? So the feeling, and here it's not saying whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, because they're all under the, you know, influence of afflictions and karma. So those six feelings that arise from the contact, that is the aggregation of, you know, let's say the eye object, the eye power, and the consciousness up through, you know, mental power, the phenomena, and the mental consciousness. Okay?
But they're not identified as any of the three things that we've been talking about at all. It's just the...
Just feelings. Yeah. Okay. Then the next six are the six elements which are the bases of production. And what, it's interesting when Nagarjuna refutes the existence of the person in Precious Garland, he uses this, these six, to see if the person is any of them. So the six elements, earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, you know, there's an awful lot of overlap here. Yeah, because the six feeling ones, don't they go in the feeling aggregate, which was number three? And the six contacts, don't they go in the volitional factors aggregate, which was number four? And here with these six, don't the first five go in the form aggregate, and then the last one go in the... in the consciousness aggregate? Yeah, there's a lot of overlap here. But the idea is that we're looking at the same material from different viewpoints, and any way we look at it, we can't find a truly existent person among these things. Okay? So whether you look at this material in terms of the aggregates, in terms of the six feelings, in terms of, you know, these six elements, in terms of the powers and the objects and the consciousnesses, we can't find anything anywhere that is a person. Yeah. Because the person, you know, is not any of those. Okay. Then, so those were 36 to 41. Then 42 to 53 are the 12 links of dependent origination. Okay, so ignorance, formation activities. What did I translate? I translated formative actions. That's how I translate formative actions. Then consciousness, name and form. Okay, the six senses, the contact, feeling, craving, clinging, existence, birth, and then aging and death. Okay, so those are the ones that we will be abandoning. Yeah. Then there's 55 of the pure class. So the first six are the six far-reaching practices: generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. Okay, then number 7 to number 24 are the 18 emptinesses, okay, which are what you meditate on when you're practicing far-reaching wisdom and when you're trying to, you know, realize the ultimate truth. So these are, it comes in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, just 18 types of emptiness. They're all emptiness, so experientially they're all exactly the same. Experientially you can't differentiate them, but conceptually we can. Okay, so I'll just run through them quickly. I don't want to, you know, I'll just read them out. So the emptiness of the internal, so that means of the five senses, emptiness of the external, so that's the six types of objects, emptiness of the internal and external, and that is the gross sense organs, then emptiness of emptiness, emptiness of the great, meaning of the ten directions, emptiness of the ultimate, meaning emptiness of nirvana, emptiness of products, emptiness of non-products, emptiness of what has passed beyond the extremes. In other words, it's passed beyond the extremes of absolutism and nihilism. Okay, emptiness of what is beginningless and endless, cyclic existence, emptiness of the indestructible, which is the indestructible Mahayana, emptiness of nature. So this is the emptiness of the final nature. Okay, emptiness of all phenomena. In other words, of the 18 constituents. Emptiness of definitions, emptiness of the unapprehendable, that is the past, present, and future. Emptiness of inherent existence, of inherently exist, the inherent existence of non-things, okay? And then emptiness of things, and emptiness of non-things, okay? So these are just, like I said, this is a whole other teaching, but we won't go into it, but just to know that those are those 18 kinds of emptiness. So those are the things of the pure class, you know, because emptiness is pure of inherent existence. Okay, then the next groups have to do with the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, which are the paths that we, you know, we meditate on, that we actualize in our own mind. So here, number 25 is the four establishments of mindfulness. So it's four of them, but it's only one number. It's only number 25, okay? Number 26 is the four thorough abandonments. So it's abandoning the afflictions that have already been generated, and stopping the ones that haven't arisen, increasing, generating the pure factors that haven't yet been generated, increasing the ones that have been generated. Okay, so that's called the four thorough abandonment. But my little, what do you see, counter-revolutionary thing is I think this is a mistranslation from the Sanskrit into the Tibetan, because there's one word, I think it's something like pahana, something like that, depending upon where, you know, if it's long A's and the M's and things, where you put the dots and dashes, it could mean abandonment or it could mean striving or effort. And in the Pali, it's translated as striving. So that's why I think that when they were translating this into Tibetan, they got that Sanskrit word confused.
What is the striving,
sort of striving? Yeah, to strive to not generate the afflictions.
Okay.
You know.
Not. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You put energy into.
Yeah,
doing that, or into increasing the good qualities you've already, the virtues you've already. Yeah. Okay. Then the next group. These are all groups of the that form the 37 harmonies. Okay. Then the next group is called the four legs of manifestation. Sometimes the four legs of miracle activity is actually four types of concentration. So it's, and they're prerequisites for being able to make manifestations, which, you know, is something a bodhisattva wants to be able to do, is make manifestations in emptiness. So they are, they're called aspiration, effort, thought, and analysis. Okay, but they're actually the names of different concentrations that you would then use to make emanations. Then the next group, so that's 27, 28, is the five powers. So faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Okay, then the next one is the five forces, which are the same as the five powers, but stronger. So again, faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Then number 30 is the seven branches of enlightenment, mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, effort, joy, pliancy, concentration, and equanimity. And then number 31 is the Noble Eightfold Path. So correct views, thought, speech, livelihood, action, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Those all form, those eight together form number 31. So it's actually way more than 55. Okay, then the next group is called the paths of calming. Okay, so number 32 is the Four Noble Truths. You know, then 33 is the four meditative stabilizations in the form realm. Okay. 34 is the four immeasurables, equanimity, love, compassion, and joy. 35 is the four formless absorptions, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and then peak of samsara. Okay. And 36 is the eight liberations, which are also different concentrations that you develop. And I won't even list those eight out here because it'll just make you confused. But it's just eight kinds of concentration that are free from the manifest activity of specific afflictions. Okay, then number 37 is called the nine serial absorptions. So those are the four form realm concentrations, the four formless realm concentrations, and then the absorption of cessation. Okay? Then the 38 is the paths of the paths of insight, which is concentration on the three doors to liberation, which are emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness. Okay, then the next groups are called the paths of special qualities. So 39 is the five clairvoyances. So you get these when you're able to have very strong samadhi. So the divine ear that can see things far away, the divine ear that can hear things far away, the knowledge of others' minds, the memory of former lives, and the knowledge of the extinction of pollutants. This is a different, you know, it's interesting because in the Theravada, the knowledge of the extinction of pollutants is actually something that, you know, only a liberated being has. And they would probably say that the five, and it's not correct calling them clairvoyances either, because clairvoyance is being able to see things. So they're more five supernormal powers. Okay? So divine eye, divine ear, knowledge of others' minds, memory of former lives, and also certain supernormal powers like walking on water and going under earth and things like that, which isn't listed in this list. And then the Theravada say the knowledge of the extinction of pollutants is the sixth one, but that one only has the Buddha can have, or an arhat can have, whereas these first five people who aren't arhats can also have. Okay. Then number 40 is four kinds of concentration: going as a hero, sky treasury, stainless, and lofty-looking lion. Loftily-looking lion. Okay, so these are, you know, different states of concentration, like in the Heart Sutra, you know, the Buddha's in the concentration of the profound illumination of all phenomena. So, you know. Okay, then 41 is the four doors of retention. Okay, so it's, and so the retention of patience or fortitude, so that you can be fearless in with respect to emptiness. The retention, I'll just list these, the retention of secret speech, the retention of words. That one's helpful for not forgetting names, thoughts, and meanings. Mm-hmm. We need that one. And the retention of meanings, for not forgetting the individual, the specific and general characteristics of phenomena. Okay, then the next groups are called the paths of effects. So the 42 is the 10 powers. So these are 10 powers that a Buddha has. I'll just again read them out. If I start describing them, I mean, it's a whole other teaching. So. Okay, but knowledge of the sources and non-sources, knowledge of the fruition of actions, knowledge of those who are superior and inferior, knowledge of the varieties of dispositions, knowledge of the varieties of trainees' interests in the great and small vehicle, knowledge of the paths proceeding to cyclic existence and to the three states of enlightenment, the enlightenments of hearers, solitary realizers, and Buddhas, knowledge of that is mindful of former states, previous lives, knowledge of one's own and others' deaths and rebirth, and knowledge of the extinction of all contamination. Okay, then the four fearlessnesses, or the four intrepidations, fearlessness. Okay, four. So these are only the Buddha has. Okay, so the Buddha's fearless with respect to the assertion that he's completely and fully enlightened with respect to all phenomena. fearless with respect to teaching what are the afflictions to abandon and what are the obscurations to, the cognitive obscurations. Fearlessness with respect to teaching the paths that lead to liberation, and fearlessness with respect to ascertaining and asserting that all the pollutions have been eliminated. Then 44 is the four sciences. Okay, so the knowledge of doctrines, of the great and specific characters of phenomena, of the many languages, and of the varieties of entities, aspects, relationships, and differences of phenomena. Then 45, great love. 46, great compassion. 47 is the eight unshared attributes of the Buddha. So these are certain qualities that only a Buddha possessed. They aren't shared by arhats. Okay, so unshared things, being non-mistaken physically, non-mistaken verbally, non-mistaken, in terms of decreasing mindfulness, always being in meditative equipoise, not having the various discriminations of one-pointedly apprehending cyclic existence. Okay, cyclic existence is to be forgotten and nirvana to be attained. In other words, not discriminating cyclic existence and nirvana, or phenomena and their emptiness as different entities. Not being disinterested, then aspiration, effortless effort, mindfulness, wisdom, the non-degeneration of liberation, the non-degeneration of the wisdom realizing liberation, and then there's three, the wisdom of the activities of body, speech, and mind, and then another three, the non-obstructed wisdom with respect to all objects of knowledge in the past, present, and future. So those are the 18 unshared qualities of the Buddha. Then there's five beings who actualize the path. So stream enterers, once returners, never returners, foe destroyers, and solitary realizers. So those are 48 to 52. And then 53, the three final fruits. And so this is the knowers of the bases, or hearers, cognizer of emptiness, the knower of the paths, or bodhisattvas, cognizers of emptiness, and the omniscient consciousness, or the Buddha's cognizers of all phenomena simultaneously. So those last three are the subject matter of the Ornament of Clear Realizations, Maitreya's text. Okay, so that was a long detour to give you some idea of when we talk about the phenomena to practice and the phenomena to discard in the establishing mindfulness on phenomena. These are the kinds of things that you're going to investigate and establish mindfulness on. Okay? Okay, but the mental factors are the most important ones here to consider. And so we classify them into deluded and purified, or afflicted and purified, and then we examine them. Okay, so first is to identify the deluded mental factors and their negative effects. So we went through these before when we did the mindfulness of the mind. We went through the six root afflictions, the 20 auxiliary afflictions. Okay, so being able to identify those in our own experience. In other words, when we're having that, when that mental state is active, knowing that we have it. So it's not just being able to go through the list and rattle off the definitions. It's being able to tell in our own mind when that affliction is there. And then to see what its harmful effects are. In other words, how it makes us physically do things, verbally speak things, and mentally think things that are detrimental and take us in the opposite way from liberation and enlightenment. Okay? So when these deluded mental factors accompany the main consciousness, okay, so they're always going to accompany a mental consciousness. These don't accompany sense consciousnesses. Okay? See, it's always a mental consciousness. So they make the mind unclear, they disturb it. Yeah, the mind becomes restless. It can't think clearly, it can't make good decisions, the mind just becomes unmanageable. Okay? And then to also be able to identify the virtuous or wholesome mental factors, in the list there were the 11 of them. Of course, there's certainly more than 11. But again, to be able to identify them in our own experience. Yeah? And here we would even include, we wouldn't just have the like 11 virtuous mental factors, but we would also have generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stabilization, wisdom. These overlap with them, but specifically those. So we would be able to see when those mental factors are in our mind and be able to identify them and know what they feel like. So when we have faith or confidence in the Buddha, to know what that feels like. When we have the mental factor of non-cruelty, ahimsa, to know what that feels like, and to be able to know, this is what it has arisen in my mind right now. Okay? And then to be able to see what its benefits are and how they make the mind manageable and clear and tranquil and energetic. When you have a virtuous mind, the mind is perky. Yeah, the mind isn't dull and falling asleep. Yeah. So, to really be able to identify these things. So this goes, very well with psychology. It also goes, when we've been talking about nonviolent communication, to identify what it calls feelings, In other words, to be able to identify the different mental factors in our mind, which ones are virtuous, in NVC language, when our needs are being met, and which ones are non-virtuous, when our needs aren't being met. That's NVC language. And Dharma language is, which ones that are virtuous that are going to make them, take the mind closer to enlightenment, and which are non-virtuous that are going to lead us further away from our spiritual goals and into all sorts of conflicts and bad mental states in this life too. Okay? So you can see how the mental factor of mindfulness is important in recognizing all these things, and how when we study Lohrig, mind and awareness, we're not just learning lists of things and we're not just learning definitions, but the whole purpose of that is to then, with mindfulness, be able to identify these mental factors when they've arisen in our mind, and then we'll know what to practice and what to avoid. Because a lot of time, when we don't know with mindfulness and introspective awareness what mental factors are manifest in our mind, then there's no way for us to, steer our mind towards enlightenment. Yeah, because we aren't even aware of what's going on in our mind. It's like when you get in the car and you drive to work, and then somebody asks you, what were you thinking about the whole drive? And you go, So the mind, there's no mindfulness in the mind. There's no introspective awareness. How can we practice it at that point? Okay? So we can really see why it's so important to have mindfulness and introspective awareness that can identify these when they're arisen in our mind. So if on the way that we're driving, their anger arises in the mind, or even a small anger that's irritation, or a small bit of jealousy or envy, that we recognize it right away, and then we know in this mindfulness of phenomena that this is something to be abandoned, and so we practice the antidotes to release it, and then we can try and cultivate a better mental state in its stead. You know, consciously cultivate a good mental state instead of just letting our mind go and hoping some virtue arises in it. It's like, good luck, you know? But how often, you know, in the course of a day do we consciously cultivate a good mental state? You know, that's what our meditation sessions are for. Yeah, we're just, you know, somewhat distracted in them. But then after we get up, yeah. So, you know, that's why I think living here at the Abbey is very helpful, because, you know, we stop at breakfast, we stop at lunch, we stop at medicine meal. You know, there's different activities throughout the day where we always stop and consciously try and generate virtuous states of mind. Yeah, so it's part of our daily schedule to do that. Yeah, and that's why we have the little verses like before you start working, which, by the way, people, you know, who are listening on the internet, you know, you can recite those verses before you go to work and set your motivation. And so, you know, this kind of thing is part of our practice of mindfulness of phenomena. Okay. Then, yeah, other ways to meditate on this fourth one is to examine the nature, the causes, the function, and the results of the three poisons, and of course any other detrimental mental factors, and of the positive virtuous mental factors. Okay? So the nature means what's their characteristic. Here we're just talking the conventional nature. Okay? What's their characteristics? How do you know when that mental factor is arisen in your mind? Be it wholesome or unwholesome, virtuous or non-virtuous, okay? Then its causes. So what causes a specific non-virtuous mental factor to arise, and what causes a virtuous one to arise? Yeah? So here it might be, you know, either causes in terms of your thoughts or causes in terms of the conditions, like we were saying, stopping at different times in the day and doing different things. Okay? Then its functions. So what are the functions of these different mental factors? Yeah, how do they change the mind? What do they motivate us to do? How do they function? Okay. And then what's the results of these? Okay, so what's the result of these different, as you go through them, afflictions? And what's the result of the different virtuous mental factors in the six far-reaching practices? So this kind of format comes on many, many times. You'll see as we go through, to understand something's nature, its cause, its function, and its result. Yeah, because if you understand those things about something, then you understand it really well. Okay? So all this takes is, you know, it's not, again, you have to learn, but you have to think about it. It's not just repeating the words, it's really developing some understanding. So you can detect it in your experience, and when you can do that, then it gives you so much energy to really, you know, steer your mind in a good direction and let go of the non-virtues. Okay? And so involved with this, again, is, you know, how do these things arise, and, you know, where do they come from? Yeah? how is it that we can be falling asleep 1 minute and daydreaming about an object of attachment the next minute? Yeah, without any drowsiness. So where do these things come from? How do they function? Okay. So, there's a few minutes for questions. You have some questions? Yeah?
In terms of the inferior phenomena to be abandoned, How do we actually meditate upon those? Is it just a normal way we contemplate those phenomena, or do we abandon them somehow in a more specific way?
Okay, so the ones that we're going to abandon, how do we meditate upon those? Well, let's say with the five aggregates, we would try and understand each of the five aggregates in terms of, you know, its nature, its their causes, its function, its results. Then we would also look within them to see if there is an I, you know, to see if the person is findable inside those aggregates, or if any of them constitute the person. Okay. Then we would do the same for the rest of them. Okay? Because those are really very, they're delineated very much to make us, not the 12 links. You wouldn't do that so much with the 12 links, but in contemplating the five aggregates, you know, then you would do that. Then you would, with the objects, the powers, and the consciousnesses, what you would do there is meditate on how all your perceptions are dependent upon those three. Yeah. Because we tend to think that when we perceive something, it's just inherently existent there, you know. And to really see, you know, how every single mind state, every single perception or cognition we have is a dependently arising phenomena. So it doesn't have its own essence. And how does it depend? You know, it depends on an object, a sense power, and a consciousness. Okay? And then similarly, seeing contact as not existing inherently, you know, contact depending on, you know, the coming together of those three, you know, the object, power, and consciousness. Same with feeling. See how feeling is dependent on contact. So you're seeing how all these things are dependent arisings. So that's very helpful for understanding that they're empty. Then with the six, the elements, you know, earth, water, fire, air, water, and consciousness, to investigate those, to see if there is a person, a findable person there, or if you can find the person in there, or if any of them are suitable to be a person. And then with the 12 links of dependent origination, there too you would meditate on how all those things are dependent and how our whole life experience is just, it exists simply because of those causes and conditions. Because we feel so real, you know? We feel that we're real, everything around us is real, it's just there. And when you meditate on the 12 links, you see, no, I exist just because the causes for me exist. That's all. Just because the causes exist. If the causes didn't exist, I wouldn't exist. Yeah? So really seeing that, you know, really brings home that the self is a dependent phenomena. Okay? That's how you would use those. Okay. Other questions?
I have a question from last week. Sort of a few things together. It's about it's how looking at the convention of the nature of mind, which is neutral, and the statement that our constructive emotions can't be eliminated from the mind, the afflictions are adventitious, they can be. Mm-hmm. So when they're talking about the Buddha nature, the conventional Buddha nature,
mm-hmm.
is it that aspect that those virtuous things can't be eliminated when they say
so
it's
the,
always there?
The conventional Buddha nature is any factor in a sentient being's mind that can be cultivated and continue to enlightenment.
So it would be that statement that the
so it would it would include the clear knowing of the mind, and it, you know, when the mind is either in a neutral state or a virtuous state, and it would include all the virtuous mental factors and virtuous states.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but you don't include in that like the clear knowing of anger. Okay.
Right. But the basic, but even the clear knowing basic nature, even though it's neutral,
yeah.
is included
yeah.
in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So if they talk about a purified state of the aggregates,
uh-huh.
which ones of these have they dumped out?
Okay. So purified state of the aggregates means you've abandoned all of the afflicted aggregates and you have the aggregates of a Buddha. Okay, so you would still have form, feeling, you know, etc. But they would not be under the, you know, influence of afflictions and karma. Okay.
I have one more detailed question. In the 18 things that a Buddha doesn't share with an arhat.
Mm-hmm.
About that thing about their the things that never decline.
Mm-hmm.
There are two things that never decline.
Mm-hmm.
And that list. It's about their good qualities never decline or something like that.
Yeah.
And you think, why wouldn't? Doesn't that also true to arhats? What's what?
Oh, but it's talking about. Yeah, the where is it? Oh, okay. Not decreasing in mindfulness. I mean, non-degeneration of liberation, non-degeneration of the wisdom realizing liberation. Okay. Yeah, I mean, but the liberation here that they're talking about is a Buddha's enlightenment. So an arhat doesn't have that.
You went through 53.
How did I?
I think the last three were each separate ones.
Yeah, were three. Yeah.
That one was not.
Yeah. If you didn't have a chance to write them all down, if you look in Meditation on Emptiness, page 201. Okay, then it has the whole list of them. Yeah. So these are just different ways of dividing things. Yeah? Because you could look about the five beings who actualize the path, and why don't they have bodhisattvas on there? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Just different ways of dividing things.
Mm-hmm. In your experience, do you really find it very helpful in your practice to have these all these different ways to look at it, or do you use them all?
Yeah, it is very helpful, I think, you know, because it they all reinforce each other. So especially, you know, these different ways of, like, looking for the person in the aggregates or in the six constituents or in the object power and consciousness, you know, it's very helpful because it's looking at the same thing from different things, and it's like, well, any way I look at it, I can't find something. Yeah? So, it's kind of like, you know, if you're looking for your wallet in the room, you can look at it just looking at the room this way. You could get under it and look up. You can get in the ceiling and look down. Yeah? And that way, you know, you can really convince yourself. Yeah. Okay, so how did they pick the 18? Well, there's also 20 emptinesses and 4 emptinesses. Okay, and 16 emptinesses.
These are just useful ones to find.
Okay. No, why this is like I said, the emptinesses are all one, the same in terms of experience, but what differentiates them is the conventionally existent phenomena that they are the emptiness of. So by dividing emptiness in this way, it's a way to emphasize to us that absolutely everything lacks true existence. Yeah? Because otherwise you might wind up like one of these people who's driving me on me crazy when I'm writing, who says that the ultimate truth is a positive phenomena, you know? And that it's inherently existent. That's completely wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Well, sometimes we get into these conversations about time.
Yeah.
I mean, so here, if you look at those 18, pretty much everything.
Everything. And so again, it's 18, and there's many overlaps, you know? Because one is of things and one is of non-things. So, you know, conditioned things and unconditioned things. And then other ones of them can fit in those. Yeah.
This makes you, the effect is to make you see everything.
Right. Yeah, the effect is to really help you see that there's absolutely nothing you can think of that has some kind of self-nature. Yeah. Okay, shall we dedicate?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Om Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Aryatara, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born of no decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions. And especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West, flourish.
Let's make special dedication prayers for the people in Egypt, that there's no violence, that nobody gets killed, nobody gets hurt, nobody generates any harmful mental states, and that the whole situation can be resolved in a peaceful manner so that people can be free and have good lives.